Welcome to a special OUJ Life this year, organized by one of our very special alumni. We're going to be talking tonight about being wholesome and holy, a Torah perspective on healthy eating. Robin, I know, wanted to do this year because we've been talking a lot about health over the time she was in college and post-marriage and post-baby. So, like, the topic of healthy eating is something which is very near and dear to me. I think it's one of the most central, most important concepts in Torah. And what we're going to talk about is why. Why is the concept of healthy eating so central to Judaism? And then hopefully get to some more practicals at the end, depending on how much time we have, which, by the way, I don't know. How much time do we have?
As much time as you can give us.
How much time? From everybody else, how much time do we have?
2 hours.
do I hear any lower bids?
We're going to need a question and answer session
too. Oh, you know, so we'll do this year part first, and then maybe we'll break and then do the practicals afterward. So there's possibly no more central concept in Judaism than the concept of Kedusha. And that's really going to be the focus of the more content-based, the more theoretical-based, piece of this evening, is to really talk about and delve into the concept of Kedusha. If we go back to even Parshat Yitro, before we enter into our eternal view with the Kadosh Baruch Hu at Matan Torah, Hashem tells us, "Va'atem tiyuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh." Source number one on your sheets is that opening paragraph before Matan Torah. Atem tiyuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. You will be to me, says the Kadosh Baruch Hu, a mamlechet kohanim, a kingdom of priests, a kingdom of kohanim, v'goy kadosh, a holy nation. And that means that that's part of who we are. That's what we're meant to live up to, is to be this mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. And so that question then becomes is, what is this concept of Kedusha? Because this concept of Kedusha is at the root of who we are. We become Bnei Yisrael when we accept the Torah. The beginning of the process of becoming Klal Yisrael is when we're birthed out of the contrasting background of Mitzrayim. That's when we become Klal Yisrael as Klal Yisrael. But that process culminates 50 days later, so you have Sfirat HaOmer that connects it. The process culminates when we finally accept the Torah and enter into that with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And this concept of Kedusha is central to what the Torah is about. If you think about the Torah itself as a structure of five books, what is the center book of Chamisha Chumshei Torah? Vayikra. Thank you, Mikey. It's Vayikra. And what's at the centerpiece of Sefer Vayikra, the center of the Torah, is Parsha Kedoshim. That's what all of Sefer Vayikra is leading up to. It's building up through dealing with removing layers of Tum'ah and understanding issues of Tahara and finally getting to the Parsha at the center of Sefer Vayikra, which is Parsha Kedoshim. So at the center of Torah is this concept of Kedusha. It's the most central concept of Torah. It's what all of Torah literally and metaphorically revolves around. And in fact, in the first Medrash, in Medrash Rabbah, we're told that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gazes into the Torah and creates the world. That the Torah is the blueprint of the world. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the Torah, which is the blueprint of the world, and through that blueprint of the world, it creates the world. And so it shouldn't then be surprising that the centerpiece of reality itself... Anybody know what the centerpiece of reality is, where all of reality stems from? It's called the Evan HaShtia, foundation stone at the centerpiece of reality. And that exists where?
On
Har HaBayit. So that exists, the centerpiece, literally the centerpiece of the physical universe is Har HaBayit. What stands ideally on Har HaBayit? Bezrat Hashem, Mihra B'Yamin. What stands at Har HaBayit? The Beit HaMikdash. And what's at the center of Beit HaMikdash? The Kodesh HaKodeshim. So it's a beautiful parallel. Literally, in the center of the Torah is the concept of Kedusha, and the Torah being the blueprint of the world, the centerpiece of all of reality, of the entire physical universe, is the Kodesh HaKodeshim. On every level of being, Kedusha is the centerpiece of what all of Torah, all of life, all of reality is about. And that demands of us to understand them. What is Kedusha? What is Kedusha all about? So if we want to understand what Kedusha is all about, then the best place to go, as we just said before, would be where? We're in the Torah.
Kedoshim.
In Vayikra, Parsha Kedoshim, right? Parsha Kedoshim, which is going to define for us what Kedusha is all about. And that's number two on your source. She's Tabrel Koladat Bnei Yisrael Vamarta Alehem Kedoshim Tihiyu Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem Elokechem. Tell all of the assembly of the children of Israel and say to them, Kedoshim Tihiyu Be Kadosh Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem Elokechem, because I, Hashem, your God, am holy. So, it tells us to be holy, but what is holiness? What is Kedusha? So Rashi says in the next source, in source number 3, he defines Kedusha as follows. He says, Kedusha is have a prushim min ha'arayot u min ha'avera. Shekol makom she'ata motzei geder erva, ata motzei Kedusha. That the definition of Kedusha is to separate oneself, to distance oneself from arayos, from immorality in the realm of sexuality. And min ha'avera, avera here means also in the realm of issues ben ish li'isha, to separate oneself in those areas. Because any time, says Rashi, that one finds a fence around erva, a fence around arayot, that's where a person will find kedusha. That's Rashi's understanding of the definition of what kedusha is, that the more one distances oneself from arayot, there one will find kedusha. And that's understood very simply from a smichot parshiot, that parsha kedushim comes right after parshat achrimot, and the end of parshat achrimot, it discusses all of the arayot. And so Rashi seems to be understanding on a simple structural level, that if we just went through all of the arayot, can you pass her a source?
Yes,
right. Great to see you. If the last thing that was discussed in the Torah was the arayot, and then it says kedushim to you, so the more you distance yourselves from the issues of arayot, there you'll find kedusha. So that's one understanding of what kedusha is all about. The Ramban challenges Rashi, as he often does. The Ramban challenges Rashi. We're not going to read through anywhere near all of the Ramban, but I left it the whole thing on your source sheet. You can take a look at it on your own afterward. It's very kedai to see it inside. If you need a Hebrew English, there are many Hebrew English Rambans out there now. It's worth reading this entire Ramban inside. But the Ramban challenges Rashi. He quotes Rashi first, Have a prushim min ha'arayot min ha'avera, shekol makom she'ata motzei geder erva, ata motzei kedusha. Lashon Rashi. And then he says, no, aval b'torat kohanim, but if you take a look in the Medrash, it says, ra'iti stam, all it says in the Midrash, says the Ramban, is, what is the definition of kedoshim to you, be kadosh? The Medrash says, prushim to you, be parush, prisha, separation, distancing oneself from the physical world. That's the definition, says the Ramban, based on the Medrash of kedusha. And that's pretty strong legs to stand on. He's quoting the Midrash. If you skip to the next underline, he says, "Ulefidati." I haven't slept in days, so if whoever's got the dinging, if it could just turn it on silent, that would be helpful. It's kids. "Ulefidati, ein haprishut hazo lifrosh min ha'arayot kedivrei harav." This is not simply separating from arayos like Rav, like Rashi said. "Avla prishuti amuskeret bechol makom b'talmud shebaaleh nikrim prushim." That the prishut that's being talked about here, it means separate from everything, meaning be somebody who separates and distances oneself from the physical world. Great. It's a much broader definition of kedusha. Then he says, and you know what? I'll even give you a couple of examples, says the Ramban. Continues on in the next line, the ha'inyan, ki ha'torah hi zira ba'arayot v'ma'achalim asurim. That the Torah warns us against arayos and ma'achalim asurim and eating things that we're not allowed to eat. Now this Ramban is crazy. The Ramban goes and challenges Rashi. He says, here's what Rashi said, and Rashi's wrong. Rashi, I've got a medrash that says explicitly against you, that it's prushim to you, and it's in every area to be parush. And I'll tell you in which ways to be parush. Be parush in arayos and in machilim asrim. Why is that crazy? How many examples did he give us? How many of them were new?
One.
He had this whole grand opening about how, but you have to be parush from everything. Why are you limiting me to one thing? Says the Ramban, no, I'll limit you to two things. It's a very weirdly structured Ramban. And you see all the examples that he gives basically are all in the realm of only arayos and achila. That's it. Linking those two things together. We have to understand this Ramban, but what's interesting is that there is a theme that we're going to find throughout all of Torah in the broadest sense, which is that these two topics, the two topics that are most associated with Kedusha, are purity in relationships, purity in their areas of sexuality, and when it comes to food. You'll find these topics discussed together in Sefer Chassidut and Kabbalah, for sure, all over the place. These two are the main inyanim of Kedusha. But it's not just in Chassidut and Kabbalah. This is something which goes across Nigla and Nistar. And you can't have a greater source in Nigla to show that it's going to go across Nigla and Nistar than the Rambam himself, Maimonides. The Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, where he codifies all of Judaism, he goes through and codifies the entirety of Again, Judaism from the Gemara and organizes it very carefully. He was a master of organization. He took Talmud Bavli, that seems on the surface to be mivulbal, that seems to be all over the place and constantly tangenting. It's intentionally done that way, and it has an underlying intentional system, but it looks mivulbal. And he goes and codifies the entire thing in the Mishnah Torah. And he has different svarim in the Mishnah Torah. And one sefer of the Mishnah Torah is called Sefer Kedusha. And if I were to open up Sefer Kedusha, I would look for something maybe about the Beis HaMikdash, about Hekdesh. There are only two topics in the entirety of Sefer Kedusha in the Mishnah Torah. Machalot Asurot and Arayot. That's it. He also has in there with Machalot Asurot Shechita. Seder, but the point is food and Arayot. That's it. So the Rambam also inherently understood that a basis in Torah, that it was emanating so clearly from Torah that you're going to see it reflected over all the areas of Torah. That these two issues of Arayot and Machalot Asurot, of Arayot and food, those are somehow more definitionally Kiddushah than anything else, even though the Ramban says that it's to be parish in all ways, somehow these are the prime elements of Kiddushah. So why Arayos and food? What links these together? Why are these the paradigms of Kedusha? So when we examine the concept of Kedusha, we can't ignore one of the main associations with the word Kedusha. It shares the same roots. We use it all the time. It's something that some of us are striving for, some of us have already achieved, and that is the process of Kedushin or marriage. Thank you. Of Kedushin or marriage. And Kiddushin is a very odd word for the term that starts off the marriage process. Why Kiddushin? Why Kiddusha? What's that all about? So the Gemara addresses this explicitly, because the opening of Masecha Kiddushin is Ha'isha Niknet. A woman can be acquired. Doesn't mean a literal monetary acquisition. It means that there's a relationship that's being established. But it talks about Niknet, Milashon Koneh. And the beginning of the Gemara, and Daf Bet Amud Bet of Masecha Kiddushin says, what's the term that the Rabbanan use? Not Hakone, not this idea of Kinyan, but rather Kiddushin. So the Gemara asks, what is this concept of Kiddushin? Why does the word Kiddushin relate to marriage, that the Rabbanan created this term? Take a look in source number 5 on your sheets at the bottom of the page. Umay Lishna Durabbanan, what is this Durabbanan term of Kiddushin? So says the Gemara, the beautiful opening of what marriage is all about, the Asrla Akule Halma Hektesh. That when somebody gets engaged, engagement back in the day was much more binding, a kiddushin engagement. So the woman becomes usher to everybody else, like Hekdesh is usher to everything except the Beit HaMikdash. Right? So not exactly the romantic moment that you were all hoping for. Right? You know, you imagine somebody comes, you finally meet, except you're the exclusion, you sit at the table, you finally meet that perfect guy, he comes, and he comes with the ring, and he says, I love you. Will you be usher to the whole world like Hekdesh? Will you marry me? And you go, I think so, but you have a better plan for the engagement, right? You know, like what does that mean? Like, where's it doesn't seem like it seems very odd. It seems almost out of sync.
That's what Hasidim do with Tanaim. When they get engaged, they like sign contracts and like...
Correct, that's much closer to the Kiddushin of back then. Exactly. And they have a waiting period between the Kiddushin process... Between the Kiddushin process and when they actually get married. Because it's binding. I mean, it's literally, it has the beginning of the marriage. Nowadays, when we just do the engagement ring and we propose, so that's not, there's no halachic status there. So here there's Kiddushin. This is literally the beginning of the marriage.
Sorry, what's Hekdesh?
Hekdesh is when I want to dedicate something to the Beit HaMikdash. I say that this thing is now Hekdesh. And therefore, that thing cannot be used for anything except for exclusive use by the Beit HaMikdash. Okay. So that's exactly what what Tosfot is going to say. Tosfot is going to open it up. Okay. So take a look at Tosfot at the next source. You took us right there. Take a look at Tosfot at the next source. He opens it up a little bit and explains the depth of what's being said here. Source number 6 in the underline. Upshita demilta mikudeshetli. The meaning of the words when a man says to a woman, hareat mikudeshetli, it means miyuchedetli, mizumenetli. That you are now uniquely bound to me. You're prepared for me. The two of us now are entering into this unique connection, this unique bond, where it's uniquely between you and me, meaning to the exclusion of all else. It's not just saying that, like, you are like Hekdesh. That again, that sounds a little bit cold and distant. Even the Tosfot is opening it up here and saying, no, what's happening when we're saying, what in the reality of Kiddushin is that we're saying that we're cutting away all of the rest of the world. Just like Hekdesh now has no connection to any part of the world but the Beit HaMikdash, you and I now have no connection to anything else but each other. Miuchedetly. You're uniquely linked to me. Mizumeretly. We're now adapted to each other, and now you're uniquely adapted to me. We're connecting to each other. That's what Kiddushin is. That's what the beginning of the marriage process is. It's cutting away everything else and creating one singular relationship, focusing all of one's relationship energies in one place, in one reality, in one relationship. At its depth, that's what Kedusha itself is really about. And that's what the Ramban means when he says, quoting Chazal, that Kedusha is related to Prishut. If you actually read further on in the Ramban, if you turn back to the first page. Rabbi Yunus. The Ramban says, in the last part of the underline, Lefichach ba katuv, therefore, this pasuk comes, achareisha parat. After naming all of the things that are totally usur, meaning after we've gone through all of these parshiot in Vayikra, we've gone through Shmini, Tazria, Metzora, Achremot, and we've listed all of these things that are usur. Vitziva, then we get a command. Bidavar klali, this overarching principle that's supposed to underlie everything after that. This davar klali, sheniye prushim min hamotarot, to separate oneself even from things that are mutar. And that's what we started, now we're really starting to get to the heart of things. To separate even to those things that are mutar. He uses it, one of the other terms that he uses here earlier in the Ramban is that we shouldn't be a naval birashut haTorah. Later on, similar to Lashon of the Ramban, the later Achronim are going to coin the term kadesh atzmecha b'mutar lecha. That the goal is to mekadesh oneself, to achieve Kedusha, through intentionally distancing oneself, even through things that are mutar. Even through things that are allowed. Kadesh atzmecha b'mutar lecha, or in the Lashon of the Ramban, v'tziva b'dvar klali, prushim min hamotarot. The essence of Kedusha is that it's about going beyond that which is usur and mutter. Those are the basic questions in life. That's the bottom line. We're not allowed to do things that are usur, and we have to do the mitzvot. What happens, though, when there's no longer an isur? There's no longer a problem. What I'm looking at is not usur. It's totally mutter. There's no problem anymore. It would seem that in that instance, there's no longer any avodat Hashem to be done. And the answer is no. That moment is exactly the moment where Kedusha begins. That's where Kedusha begins. That's definitionally the point of the beginning of the Avodah of Kedusha. When there's nothing, when nothing is mutar. Sorry, when nothing is asr and everything is mutar. Now I can get to the fundamental question. What am I really committed to in my life? More specifically, who am I really committed to in my life? Is my whole goal of life to get out of mitzvot so then I can finally focus on myself? Or is my whole goal in life to be focused on HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Have I truly entered into a relationship of Kedusha, of Kiddushin with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Of exclusivity of relationship completely focused on the other, like in a marriage it's all about focused on giving, focused on the other? Have I entered into a reality of Kedusha, of Kiddushin with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Have I worked on myself to be parish, to separate myself from everything in this world, and dedicate myself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even when there isn't a mitzvah in that moment? Or do I reveal in that moment that at my core, I'm not really focused on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'm really interested in myself? I have to do the mitzvah. I want to get the mitzvah out of the way. Because then once I get them out of the way, then I can start doing the things that I want to do. That's a very deep question. And I'm saying it in the most intense way possible. Kedusha is possibly the most intense concept possible in Torah. And these are levels to achieve. We're not even, we're going to continue to open this up. I think we're going to talk about the deepest levels of Avodah here. But I'm presenting it as such because this is what we should be striving for. It's not like, you're good, you're a Kadosh, so here's the Torah. It's like, no, this is what you need to strive for your entire lives, personally and as a nation, is to become that Goy that is Kadosh. And this is why this is a lifetime's worth of work. This is why this is the centerpiece of Torah. It's because after we've gone through all of Shas, and after we've gone through all of Poskim, now we can start, no, we shouldn't wait until then, but now we can start working on Kedusha. That's when Kedusha begins. Let's bring it back to our issues. Why is Kedusha most explicitly then linked to food and Ariot? Why those two things of all things? Because those are the two areas of life that I'm both compelled to be engaged in by nature. We're here, we need to live, we need to eat to live. And we're here to reproduce. We have to have kiyum in this world. That's how our continuity in this world is through having children. We need to be engaged in these two areas of life. And additionally, these are two areas of life that we have to be engaged in that are also innately and inherently physically pleasurable. You can't distance it. It's part of the action itself, is that it's a physically pleasurable action. I have to eat. I have to reproduce. It's a part of life. The question is, once I get past the aspects of these areas that are usser, and I'm now confronted with a situation where the reality in front of me is totally mutar, everything is allowed, what's my focus? At that moment, I absolutely do not need to focus on God. If I choose, I can take Him completely out of the picture. Even more so, I can focus on myself and indulge in my own physical pleasures in a way that's explosive and mutar all at the same time. To eat the richest dessert is delicious and completely mutar. And for one to have a physical relationship with one's spouse is an incredibly pleasurable experience. It's also totally mutar. Both are 100% mutar. There's nothing usser about either of those situations, and I can completely indulge in my own personal gratification. And if I do, I've missed out on everything that it means to be a Jew. Everything that it means to be a Jew underneath the surface. At that moment, I'm confronted with the concept of Kedusha. In that critical moment where I've gotten past the halachot, I reveal my true essence. I reveal my true nature. Am I, at my core, really about myself? Am I selfish? Or am I, at my core, really about God? Am I selfless? And it comes up constantly in all the shirim that I give. To me, I think that's the most fundamental. If you break Judaism down, that's the most fundamental question of Judaism, is the struggle between selfishness and selflessness. We're born into this world. You have a child. We're born into this world on the one extreme of the spectrum. Not to judge children. You know, you said you're a judging person. I hope you don't judge children so harshly, right? That not to judge children, but children are selfish, right? That's just inherent nature. They're born, and what do? They cry because they either want to eat, to sleep, or to be changed. But I need to be taken care of. It's all about me. It's fine. It's totally normal. The goal is from the moment of one's birth till the moment of one's death, to what extent do I work on myself to get away from that selfishness? And to transform myself into a selfless being, dedicated to giving to others that are all created B'Tselem Elohim, and ultimately giving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself in any way that I can, giving myself up for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But in those moments, coming back to our two topics, I have the opportunity in those moments to be Kadosh, to show that I don't keep halakha simply because I'm required to, or because I'm afraid of punishment, or even because I'm working towards my chelek in Olam Haba. That's not why I'm keeping the mitzvot. I keep halacha, I keep the mitzvot, because my whole being is dedicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Avodas Hashem. And therefore, even when I no longer have an explicit commandment, I'm going to transform this moment and make it all about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm going to ignore the natural, inherent, physical drives of the moment and elevate everything to God. That's Kedusha. That's what Kedusha is all about. In the moment when I put food into my mouth, In the moment when one engages in physical intimacy with one's spouse, whether I focus on my own personal pleasure or whether I focus on God, the moment it's going to look exactly the same. When I pick up that piece of food, I put it in my mouth, nobody knows what's going on in my mind. Nobody knows what my kavanot are. Nobody knows what's happening. And it's kosher. And I said a bracha. So I'm good. Right? We're fine. Right? No demarcations on the shidduch resume. Right? I did everything I was supposed to do. The food was glot. The food was 100% mahadrin. And I said the bracha nice and loud to make sure everybody knows I'm good. But from that moment on, nobody knows. Nobody knows what's going on in my own internal world. So I read the shidduch resumes are useless. Nobody knows what's going on in my internal world. That's what really counts. My internal world. The only two beings who truly know my intent in that moment are myself and a Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's a very powerful moment. Those are the only two beings who actually know what's happening from that point forward. At its depth, the most intense moment between myself and a Kadosh Baruch Hu is in that moment. It's the test of what my life is really about. At my core, am I really about serving and connecting to me? Or am I really about serving and connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? That's the question of Kedusha, and that's the central question of life. It's therefore no surprise that these are the two central issues that take us all the way back to Gan Eden itself. These are going to be the two central issues of tikkun, of fixing the world, of bringing about a tikkun from when the world itself fell at the very beginning in Gan Eden. What was going on in Gan Eden? What was the chait in Gan Eden? The Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra, which was an act of
eating.
That which made mankind fall was broken achila, was broken eating. And so the tikkun's going to come through eating. To keep consistent with the theme of our shir, it wasn't just eating though. If you actually take a look in the psukim, back to page number 2, take a look in source number 7. So in addition to the underlined pasuk vav, which clearly the issue was through eating there, Vatera ha'isha ki tova eats lema'achal, she saw that it was good to eat, v'chiyatavahu le'inayim, and suddenly she had a desire to, it was desirous to her eyes, v'nechmara eats la'askil, v'tikach mi piryo v'tochal, and she took it and she ate it, v'titem gam li'isha ima v'yochal. So there's clearly eating involved, but it wasn't just eating. Where did it all come from? So it's a little bit more hidden in the text, but it's right there. We often also differentiate it because it happens in the space between Perek Bet and Perek Gimel. But the Prakim are totally meaningless in Chumash. They're an arbitrary division created by mankind. They weren't even created by Jews. That doesn't make it inherently wrong, but it's certainly not divine. The paragraphs in the Torah are what are important. The Torah makes no distinction in the paragraphs between what we call Perek Bet and Perek Gimel. And let's take a look then at the flow of the Psukim, which is why it's so critical not to read them based on the Prakim and the Psukim. What happens? In the previous part of the story, Adam is lonely. Lotov ha'adam hayot levado. It's not good for man to be alone. So God says, Aselo ezer kenegdo. I'll make him a mate. And so eventually he does. He goes through a process in order to realize what exactly he needs, what exactly the nature of connectivity with the spouse is all about. Kadosh Baruch Hu creates woman, and man and woman come together. And after man and woman is created, it says in the underline of Pasuk Chafei, Vayushnem arumim ha'adam v'ishto v'lo yitposhashu. The two of them weren't wearing any clothing, the man and his wife, and they were not embarrassed. Lo yitposhashu. It's a very strange pasuk. Are embarrassed about what? What was the issue? And the Mefarshim bring out that what was happening here is that the two of them were involved in a physical relationship. They came together as a husband and wife. They fully bonded. But this lo yitposhashu, some bring up that there was somehow some sort of crack in that physical relationship. Something went wrong. Something wasn't 100% l'shem shamayim there. And that's why the very next pasuk stems from this pasuk. It's all one paragraph in the Chumash. Somehow the nachash emerges as a result of their physical relationship, showing us the two cracks in Gan Eden were in the realm of Arayot and the realm of Achila, which then become the central tikkunim that if we're trying to get back to Gan Eden, we're trying to fix the world and bring us back to a stage of Gan Eden so we can make the ultimate tikkun. Those are going to be the two primary areas. They therefore become the two central areas of the people who are meant to fix this world, the Jewish people. And at the centerpiece of the guidebook to fix that is the Torah. The centerpiece of the Torah is Kedusha. It's all one inyan. We're fixing the most central issues in the Bria itself. That's what Kedusha is all about. It's a little bit, it's not true, it's a little bit of what Kedusha is all about. Is that Kedusha is about, again, just to summarize this piece of the shir, what Kedusha is about is again, taking those two prime examples of those moments where everything becomes mutar, there's no longer an isser, everything is mutar, and the question is, in that moment, am I going to focus on myself? Or am I going to show how much I'm in a Kiddusha, in a relationship of Kiddusha with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that I'm elevating and dedicating every ounce of my being to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though I don't have to in this moment, I want to because I'm totally dedicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm Kiddushin, I'm Parush from everything else. I'm separate totally from the physical world. I'm just focused on my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm separated from all other things. Because I'm dedicated only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm connecting only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Questions, thoughts, comments on the conceptual piece of Kedusha? Great, yeah.
Like, aren't there some opinions that hold that you are supposed to have, like, pleasure in this world?
Good, so we'll get there. Yes. Good. That's the only question, then we'll keep going, because we're going to go right towards that point. Excellent. So let's focus now on how this translates into eating specifically, because that was the topic of the show. These were the two issues that are totally united. But let's focus on the eating side of things. What does it mean to eat properly? What does it mean to eat in the Kadosh way? So again, we're not talking about things that are usr and mutter here. We're talking about a stage beyond that. So let's start giving practical examples, right? So now I'm good. That's what I prepared earlier. Now we're in my happy zone. What are practical examples? So you walk into a cafeteria, right? And you go and you want to get lunch. And you see a whole plethora of choices in front of you. Now you've walked in, and again, the food is kosher. There's no isser. Everything here is mutter. But as you're going about now, and let's speak personally. We're all working on this together. I'm standing there, and now I have to choose for myself. What do I want to eat? Where is my motivation coming from? Why am I eating? What do I want to eat is going to be determined by where it's coming from. Am I looking and I'm just like, oh, I'm salivating over that thing. And I go for the thing that looks the tastiest. I go for the thing that my stomach is going for. That my taste buds are going for. Very often, those are going to be the things that are the most unhealthy. Right? So I go and I go for the, you know, deep-fried, heavily sauced chicken eggs, chicken wings or chicken nuggets or whatever it is. Right? That's what I'm going to go. That's going to be my lunch. That's thinking on a level of Kedusha. That's thinking about myself. I've now gotten past the Isser. The food is kosher. I've now gotten to the Heter and I've said my Bracha. What's going into my mouth? Why am I eating? Alternatively, then, if I look at it and say, no, why am I eating? My whole purpose in being here and coming to lunch is because I need more koch. I need more strength. I'm getting a little bit tired. I'm getting a little bit hungry. And so I need to refuel. And that's what I'm doing, is I'm going and I'm going to take food because I want to give myself more energy to re-energize myself for my Avodas Hashem for the rest of the day. Two totally different mindsets as I stand there, and one I'm going to pick. One I'm going to pick the greasy chicken wings, and the other one I'm going to pick a salad. I'm going to pick some fruit. One of them is going to be totally focused on my taste buds. One of the other ones is going to be focused totally on energizing myself. I've never seen somebody go and have an apple, and after they eat the apple, they're like, oh man, I go lay down for a few minutes. I take a nap. You know, that long Shabbos afternoon after that apple for lunch. Like, you know, that never happens. Why? Because an apple energizes you. An apple is full of nutrients. An apple is going to give you coffee for the rest of the day. You're eating that to give yourself energy. I have seen many times people go and they come with me to certain, I'm not going to say on recording, I want to speak negatively on any stores on Main Street, but go to certain stores on Main Street that I'm sure that you can think of, and after eating a full meal there, they can't get up for the next 2 hours. Which is crazy. You think about that, that's really crazy. Because the reason that we eat is because our energy is depleted. But when we eat foods like that, that are so destructive, when we're only thinking about our taste buds, we didn't realize how counterproductive we're being. That we're actually requiring our energy to utilize all of its remaining resources just to process the horrible food that we just put into our system to the point that we can't even move. So we don't think about these things before we go and do them. It's incredibly destructive. And that's the basic question. Who am I eating for? Am I eating for my taste buds or am I eating for HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And it goes deeper than that. I mean, we're only going to, you know, touch upon a few levels. This is infinite work. This is work that's going back to being Metaken Gan Eden. You know, we're not even, we're just hovering over the surface. We're not even scratching it, right? And then we get to the food. And let's say I make the right choice, and I choose the apple. So then what happens? I say a bracha. So the joke is how long does it take to say a bracha? How long does it take to say a bracha?
Depends what you're eating.
No, it depends on the length of your arms. It depends on how long it takes for your arm to get from the food to your mouth. Right? That's how long the bracha takes, right? And we don't even realize. It becomes second nature. That the bracha becomes a means to get to the food. I'm not eating. I'm not taking food because I want to say a bracha. I'm getting through the bracha to get to the food. The bracha's in the way of the food. To stop and to think about the bracha. To think about the bracha. Baruch atah Hashem. Kadosh Baruch Hu, Baruch. You're the source. You're the brecha. You're the wellspring. You're the source of all bracha. You're the source of all bounty in this world. You, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yud Kei Vav Kei, you're the infinite source. Hayahu Veviyah, you're the infinite source of all things in this world. Baruch HaShem Elokeinu, who still yet, beyond the fact that you are beyond the world, that you're Hayahu Veviyah, you're still Elokeinu, you still exist within Teva, you still exist within nature. You're still connected to me, Elokeinu, you're our God in this world. Melech HaOlam. That you are Borei, you create the pre, you create the fruits of the eights of the tree. Thank you, HaKadosh Baruch. Thank you for creating the fruit of the tree. And I take that bite of the apple. And you get a really good apple, right? You get a ripe, good, fresh, if you're lucky, organic apple. Maybe even pick it off a tree one day. That's where they come from, by the way. That's why we have the Chazal instituted brachas, knowing that we one day would think that apples grew in supermarkets, right? That's just going to be delivered to our doors. So that Borei Priya eats. You created this whole thing, you created the tree, and you created this beautiful apple. And I take a bite. But it's not over there. Because then when I take the bite, what's now happening? Now we're talking about a good apple here. We're talking about real apples, right? Oh, so there's this explosion of taste in my mouth. If you ever tasted a real apple, you ever tasted a real orange, this explosion of amazing taste in your mouth. What are you thinking? Nobody else can tell. I won't tell. It's not my business. I won't know. Nobody else knows. Comes back to what we're talking about. Who are the only two beings that know what's happening in your mind at that moment? You and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What am I focusing on? And I think to myself, oh, this is an amazing apple. It was so worth it. I'm glad I spent that money. Man, that whole food store was totally expensive, and I wasn't sure it was worth it. But it was worth it because for this taste, for me to get this physical enjoyment, it was worth putting my money down for that apple. Or I'm thinking, no. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Borei Priya Eitz, thank you for making apples. And with every explosion of taste on my tongue, I'm being molded to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, Kadosh Baruch Hu. I need to eat to live. A car needs fuel to go. You could have made all food taste like gasoline to give me fuel to keep going, and I would have had to eat it, because I can't live without it. Without it, I would die. But you chose not only to make food of incredible variety, but of an incredible variety of amazing taste, just so that way I could give more hodah to you. And with every bite I take, with every explosion on my taste buds, thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm consistently in that space of hodah. Am I recognizing how much effort HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into that apple? Never going to look at apples the same again. Right? Think about how much work HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into that apple. Every single little bit of that apple has tremendous koach in it. And that koach can be part of my body. But you know why that normally don't get most of that koach? It's the lost art of chewing. We don't chew anymore. We swallow things whole. Right? We just go and we gobble things up. We down things. Right? That's where all these terms come from. Right? That's not how it goes. We're supposed to chew. You're supposed to chew minimally 24 times, I think it is, before you're supposed to swallow something. Try doing that once. You're thinking to yourself, like, what am I doing here? I have places to go, people to see, things to do. And the answer is no. If you're sitting there and you have that apple, you're only supposed to be eating right now. Something we forget. Only supposed to be eating right now. Why is it important to chew? When you don't chew, you deny what a Kadosh Baruch Hu means, that I'm just trying to get the taste in my mouth. When I'm chewing, I'm saying, no, why am I eating? Because I want to suck every nutrient out of this apple. I don't want to let anything in a Kadosh Baruch Hu's world be levatala. Nothing in this world go to waste. So I slowly chew it more and chew it more to draw out all of the energy from that apple. To infuse myself with koach to go forward in my day. I'm eating for you. That's the only reason I'm eating. I'm eating for you. And that's just the basics. Those are simple things. You know, talking about like just slowing down when we're eating. It's very hard to slow down when we're eating. I was once by... there's a good story behind this, clearly, but for another time. So I was once by my former sensei in Yerushalayim, and I went to go visit him. And he's an incredible, incredible person. And he was going to a shir in deeper in the Nim and Bonanut in Bat Ayin at the time, and he shared with me one of the meditations that they were working on when I went to visit him. And I'm not even going to give you the whole meditation. One of them was very simple. There was a whole long process here. There's a little piece of it. Try this. Try it. Just, even if you don't do it, just note it next time that you eat. He said, when you go and you take your fork and you start eating something with your fork, he said, slow down. He said, after you take the bite off of your fork, don't let your hand put the fork into the next bite of food until you finish chewing and swallowing the bite that's in your mouth. Try this next time. You'll be like frightened. You'll be horrified that you have absolutely zero control over your body. Zero control. Your body is in control. We have not yet even begun to have our soul override our body and be in control of our body. That fork's going right for the food. Even if it knows it's got to wait. On deck, ready to go. Got to get the next bite in. As quickly as you can. Right? Try it next time. See if you're even able to, for one bite, just force your hand to not go into that food. It's a humbling moment if you just try it out. It's a humbling moment. That's what the pasuk says. That's the one layer of what the pasuk means when it says source number eight says tzadik ochel lesova nafsho. Why does a tzaddik eat? What makes the eating of a tzaddik different than the eating of another person, of a regular person? Tzaddik ochel, a tzaddik eats lesova nafsho. A tzaddik eats to fulfill his soul, to give his soul life, to invigorate his spiritual well-being so he can go forward and serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu more deeply. Tzaddik ochel lesova nafsho. And as an aside, by the way, uveten rishayim techsar. A Rasha who's only eating for himself, he's always hungry for more. He's always looking for the next bit to eat. Nothing ever satisfies him. You can always have another piece of cake. You can always have another cookie. You can always have another thing. There's always more to eat. That's what the pasuk says. Vetin Rashaim Tachsar. The betin of the Rasha is always going to be empty. It's always going to be looking for more. Tzadik ochel usova nafsho. Incredibly, this is reflected. And when you see these sources, you realize how deeply these issues are. That they sort of just pop up everywhere when you keep your eyes open for them. Even in the most unexpected of places. Here is possibly one of the most unexpected places. One of my favorite sources, because it literally comes out of nowhere. Beginning of Shulchan Aruch, which nobody learns because nobody learns the beginning of Shulchan Aruch. So the beginning of Shulchan Aruch says, talks about how you get up in the morning, what you need to do, how you get dressed, how you go to the bathroom, saying Asher Yatzar. So it talks about the bracha of Asher Yatzar. And very interestingly, for whatever reason, despite the fact that the Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Yosef Karo, doesn't go through the meaning of every single bracha, or almost any bracha, for some reason, by Asher Yatzar, he goes through literally what every phrase means. You can take a look in there, it's very beautiful. Siman Vav, the whole first Se'if, is him translating for you every single phrase of Asher Yatzar, an incredibly powerful bracha. And he gets to the final piece of the phrase, which is Umafli La'asot. Rofei Kol Basar, Kadosh Baruch Hu heals all flesh, Umafli La'asot, and does wondrous things. So what are these wondrous things? So one would expect in the context of Asher Yatzar, so the wondrous things that he's doing is that our bodies function, and that we can actually, we take things inside of our body, and we can actually pass them through, and that we live and we survive. That's Mafli La'asot, that's a wonder enough for me. And the Shulchan Aruch offers a couple of interpretations of what Mafli La'asot could be. And very interestingly, the Ramah takes it to a whole different level. The Ramah says in source number 9 in the underline, the Odish Tavarish. I'll give you another explanation, possible explanation of what Umafli La'asot means. Shemafli La'asot, b'meshesh shomer ruach ha'adam b'kirbo. That a Kadosh Baruch Hu keeps man's spirit inside of his physical body. V'kosher davar ruchani davar gashmi. And that he links a spiritual thing to a physical thing. For another shir, and I've given the shir before, and it's worth sitting on, and it's a whole other piece. There is no greater wonder in life. There is nothing more wondrous and incredible and impossible in life than a Kadosh Baruch Hu takes a spiritual soul, which wants nothing to do with the physical world, and a physical body, which wants nothing to do with spirituality, and says, okay, you two, I'm going to force the two of you together, and you're going to be one being. That is the most wondrous thing that there is. That is Mafli La'asot. And that's why, according to many minhagim, and it's a powerful minhag, if you don't do it, to think about maybe doing it this way, that in the morning when you say Asher Yatzar, we connect to which bracha? Connected to Elokai Neshama. That those two words, and when I wake up in the morning, and my soul comes back down from Shammai when I wake up into my body, so my body and my soul reconnect, then I express the wonder of what just happened to me by saying Asher Yatzar, and the words Umafli La'asot link the bracha about my body to the bracha about my soul. Elokai Neshama Shanat B'Torahi. It's an incredibly powerful moment if we think about that. That's the Ramah. There's nothing to do with our topic whatsoever. Why did I quote it? Because of the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah did not need to add anything. That was beautiful. Leave the Ramah alone. He was great. And yet the Mishnah Berurah says something which is totally unnecessary and incredibly powerful and totally out of left field. Source number 10. He quotes here from the Mikubalim, because he's the Mishnah Berurah, and although we thought we were reading Pshat Halacha, I hate to break it to you, but you can't associate any parts of Torah from other parts of Torah. And all Torah is one, and all Torah is connected, and it's all part of the great orchard, the great pardes. And so he says, "Ubekavanot katuv, dehaneshama." Hear the words. You think I was making this up? Dehaneshama nehenet meruchniyut hamaachal. That the neshama enjoys the ruchnius of the food that we're eating. V'haguf nehena migashmiut hamaachal. And our body enjoys this physicality of the food. And that's why food is what keeps the two linked together. The only reason that food is what keeps us alive is because food is able to feed both our spiritual side and our physical side, and that's what keeps those two linked together. Incredible concept. Which gives even more depth through Tzaddik Ochel Lesova Nafsho. When you take a piece of food, you can look at that piece of food, and if you look deeply enough, you can choose what part of this food am I eating? Am I connecting to the depth of the koach of ruchnius in this food? And am I eating to be sovea my nefesh? Or am I totally looking at the physicality of this food and being sovea my beten? Filling my stomach. What's my focus? The way that the deeper svarim will talk about it. Am I looking at the sparks of Kedusha? The nitzotzot of Kedusha, the sparks of Kedusha, that ruchnius is inside of this food? And am I trying to bring them out to reveal the Kedusha in the food, the nitzotzot of Kedusha in this world? Or am I focused only on filling my physical self? Which one am I focused on? What am I all about? The Malbim beautifully brings out the concept. If you take a look, the Malbim is an incredible perush on Chumash Bechla. That's in my Haskalah, but the Malbim is incredible. In the Malbim, sometimes he's got his regular perush, which is a brilliant and was a revolutionary perush. And you can read the Malbim. There are sometimes, even though the Malbim was revolutionary in that he included many more things and was much more, gave a much longer perush and a much more elaborated explanations of things, despite that, there are times when the Malbim's like, yeah, but I have something really, really important to tell you. But it's kind of like a whole essay, and it sort of doesn't fit in any pasuk, so like, hold on one second, I'm going to make a line, and I'm going to give you this whole essay below the line. And here's the really cool stuff. So if you go to the Parshiot about the Mishkan, the Malbim has this whole introduction where he goes through on the deepest levels how there are three things in the world, three things in reality that parallel each other. The universe, the Mishkan, and a human being. And those three things are parallel in every way. Those two things are parallel in every way. The world, the Mishkan, and human being. Focusing on the piece that the Mishkan and the human being are parallel to each other, so then every single aspect of ourselves are parallel to a different thing. I think he brings it out there. There are actually different interpretations of which parts of the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash are connected, which parts of the human body. The menorah is going to be the eyes. The ketoret is going to be the nose. I think the Malbim actually doesn't go in that direction. Many of us assume that the ketoret is the nose. What's the Mizbeach? What's the Mizbeach on the outside? The Mizbeach that we bring the Korbanot on? That's the stomach. The stomach is our Mizbeach. Think about that when we eat. Can you imagine if we thought about that when we eat? Can you imagine if we had a Beis HaMikdash? Shalosh Regalim. You're going to be seen before HaKadosh Baruch Hu when you go up there. And after taking a plane and going to Israel, and you go and then you walk from the airport, you drive from the airport to Yerushalayim, and you walk up to the Beit HaMikdash because you want to bring your Korban Lifnei Hashem, and you reach into your knapsack, and you pull out a greasy, disgusting bag of fast food and hand it to the Kohen. You're lucky if all he does is throw it back in your face. You're lucky if all he does is throw it back in your face. To think about that. That when we eat, we're choosing what we want to put on our internal mizbech. Think about it like that. I'm being makriv before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a lot of depth there also. That assumably HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need to eat. Why does the Beit HaMikdash have a mizbech at all? Why do we bring korbanot? That one layer that I assume is being brought out about all this is that in the same way, if we're saying that when we eat, there's a spiritual side of food and a physical side of food, and when we eat, it keeps our soul connected to our body, then the Beit HaMikdash itself is what connects Shamayim V'aretz. It connects the heavens and the earth. It's where the Gemara says heaven and earth kiss. And so I assume that the korbanot then are the food that keeps that unity between the Shamayim and the Aretz, between heaven and earth. I strongly suspect that. Because I can't help myself, I'll give you one example of that. Which when it struck me, I was like, oh, it makes so much sense. I think this makes sense. The one time in Chumash where we see that there's a massive amount of korbanot that are being brought. In Chumash where there's just an endless amount of being korbanot being brought. Where's the most korbanot that are brought in all of Chumash? Underratedly. Because a lot of other stuff going on in that story. We've already read it in the cycle of the Parshiot.
There you go.
We've already read it in the cycle of the Parshiot.
Oh, we're saying this one. Already.
There were only so many Parshiot so far.
Yeah.
Parsha Noach. When Noach comes off the teva, he gives one of every kosher animal. He brings kosher animals. Yeah, one of every kosher animal on his beach. Mass korbanot. And I was thinking at one point that makes a lot of sense. Because what happened to the world? The world just went through a mabul. The world was on the brink of death. And it needed to be reinvigorated. It needed to be given new life. And so the first thing he needs to do when he walks off the teva to give new life to the world is to bring a massive amount of korbanot. Because again, that's mekashir davar ruchani, but davar gashmi. He's re-giving life to the world. B'derech HaAfshar, and not exactly our topic. The topic for us is the stomach. Is that there, that's where we're bringing onto our own Mizbeach. Thinking when we eat, what am I bringing onto my Mizbeach? It's an incredible Gemara that says, take a look in source number 11. Incredible Gemara. The whole discussion in this area of Masechet Ta'anit is very beautiful. It talks about, is it good to fast? Is it not good to fast? It talks about, is it good to be a Nazir? Is it not good to be a Nazir? And what really is it struggling underneath the surface in those issues is, why are you being purished from this world? Should you be purished from this world? If you are, you're doing for that reasons, and that comes back to what you asked. I'm sorry that I never linked it back to what you asked. Shouldn't you engage in pleasure in this world? The answer, basically, we already said this, but the answer is yes. But when I'm experiencing that pleasure, a person is supposed to experience every pleasure in this world to give hoda'ah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for having created it. I'm doing it for God. That's the point. And so that's, I think, the struggle in the Gemara here in these issues with the Nazir and with Tanis, with fasting and all of these things. Why am I doing these things? Why am I going into extra preshut? Is it because I'm denying myself the physical pleasure of this world and therefore it's a good thing? Or am I denying myself the physical pleasure in the world in a negative way because I'm missing out on the opportunity to give hoda'ah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And the Gemara is going back and forth. And in that context, the Gemara says incredibly, hear the words, source number 11. These little snippets of Gemara, these one-liners, contain the worlds in them. Va'amar Rabbi Elazar, le'olam yimod adam atzmo, a person should always measure themselves, ki'ilu kadosh sharoi betoch me'av, as if there were kadosh, kedusha, resting in their intestines, resting in their stomach. A person should always live like that, think like that, recognize that. Tosfot says, mazeh, Kadosh Sharei B'toch Me'av, that Kadosh is within my insides. He says, Kadosh HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you'll find a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That godliness is there. That's my Mizbeach. That's my Mikasher Davar Ruchani B'davar Gashmi. That's my question of, am I living a life of Kedusha or am I not living a life of Kedusha? Le'olam Yimur Adamasu Kilu Kadosh Sharei B'toch Me'av. That's where Kedusha lives. That's where Kedusha lives. Those are some examples of ways to think about eating, practically think about eating, practically to do when we're thinking about food, that what we choose to eat is so important for the health of our bodies. We haven't even talked about practical health considerations yet, but for the health of our bodies, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu demands of us, we have to take care of ourselves, the command of the Torah. The Rambam, who again doesn't waste any words, in Perek Dalet, I think it is, of Hilchot Yisodei of Hilchot Deot, beginning of the Mishnah Torah. Again, we don't learn the beginning of anything. We're so busy writing to the middle of things. The beginning of it, he talks about how it's a requirement to be healthy, and he gives there, he talks about health advice. Halakha l'maisa, you have to be healthy. But these are a few ideas of a few ways that when we're going and we're sitting down to eat, what are we choosing to eat? That's where it all begins. What are we choosing to eat? It's kosher, mazel tov. I said a bracha, great. What am I choosing to eat? And who am I choosing to eat for? And then once I've made that choice of what to eat, how am I eating it? Who am I eating it for? And to go deeper and deeper and deeper with these different levels and do your own research. Levels of hitbonenut, of contemplation, of depth of what these things are really about. We're coming on an hour. We could talk about, we could shift gears and talk about more kind of more specific health-oriented pieces, get even more practical in a certain way, though we'll lace it with Torah anyway because I can't help myself. Or we can, but we'll pause either way here for a minute or two if there are people, it's getting late, people have to head out. So we'll pause for a minute or two and then we'll go from there. Okay. So let's go back inside and let's talk about some specific issues relating to how to think about how to eat very, very practically. You know, in our day and age, food is very complicated. Food has become a very difficult reality to navigate. The modern-day food system is not designed for health. It's not designed for health. What I actually want to do is, I still want to give it a backdrop of Torah, because I think it creates more meaning that way, meaning these things aren't just arbitrary things. I think that there's a lot of depth in the fact that our food is very complicated, not just because we're coming to the end of the process of the 6,000 years that will lead to Yimot HaMashiach, and so we're coming to the fevered pitch of having to make those final tikkunim, and the struggle that comes along with it. But I think it's important to have that backdrop to see that these things are not just arbitrary ideas, that I think that they are really rooted in Torah concepts. And while this gets a little more hyper-specific, I was thinking about this a lot, I always think about these a lot in these parshiot. We just came out of Parsha Toldot. And Parsha Toldot, that's going to be our backdrop for the specifics of food. Why Parsha Toldot? So we'll see in a second. So Parsha Toldot talks about the birth of Yaakov and Esav. What's the difference between Yaakov and Esav? So if you take a look in the Psukim in source number 12 from last week's Parsha, when they start to differentiate themselves, it says in Pasuk Chavzayin, source number 12, Vayigdelu ha-ne'arim, they grew up, and then these twins started to differentiate. Vayhi Esav ish yodea tzayid ish sadeh. Esav was an ish, a person who knew tzayid, on a pshat level, seemingly who knew how to hunt. Ish sadeh, a person of the field. V'Yaakov ish tam yoshevo alim. And Yaakov was an ish tam, was simple in the positive sense. We often, simple gets a bad rap. Simple is very good, meaning simple, whole, perfect. And he was sitting in the tent. And this suddenly is supposed to be telling us, as they grow up now, what differentiates between Yaakov and Esav. And so Rashi, drawing from Chazal, explains what's really happening here, the essential difference, the core difference between Yaakov and Esav. When it says Yodea Tzayid, what does it mean? He knew Tzayid. Yodea Tzayid. Say it was Anter. So says Rashi, he says, no, Maza Yodea Tzayid, source number 13, Latzoru l'ramot et aviv befiv. He knew how to trap things with his mouth. He knew how to trap people with his words. Esav was the first person to embody the concept of lying. He was the ultimate liar. He was the ultimate faker. That's who Esav was. He spent his whole life tricking his father and making his father think that they were still twins. Making his father think that he was really a tzaddik. As opposed to Yaakov, in the bottom of source number 13, Ishtam, he says, "Ainu baki b'cholila ella kilibo kein b'fiv." Inside and outside, he was totally the same. Yaakov was totally transparent. He wasn't echad b'lev echad b'peh. He wasn't one way inside, one way outside. He wasn't a liar. He was completely all about truth, and that's what Yaakov is. Yaakov is the ish emet. Titen emet li Yaakov, chesed l'Avraham. We know chesed is linked to Avraham. Emet is linked to Yaakov. That's what the pasuk is saying. Titen emet li Yaakov. One of the core elements of his midas is that his midas, the midah of emet, on the contrasting background of Esav, whose whole midah is sheker. Esav is kulo sheker. Why are we talking about Yaakov and Esav? There couldn't be anything more critical to talk about. This is literally its own shiur on its own. I was preparing this today for next week. I'm teaching it in our Women's Midrashah program on campus. So we're going to have a whole shiur just on this topic of the Emet and Sheker relationship between Yaakov and Esav. But to give you one small piece of it, because it links into Aryanim, which we're not going to talk about there, because we're going to talk about food, which is that Chazal tell us that there are four stages of exile that take place over the course of Jewish history that are learned out all the way from the second Pasuk in Bereishit. V'aretz hayta tohu, 1, vavohu, 2, choshech, 3, alpenei tahom, 4. Tohu, it says, is bavel, bo is prasumadai, choshech, which is our now, we just entered into Kislev, we're coming to Chanukah. Chanukah, we fight Yavan, and so we fight the darkness of Yavan. The choshech of Yavan, choshech, alpenei tahom, the choshech of Yavan, what do we fight it with? With the light of Chanukah. There's this clear struggle between light and darkness in our struggle with Yavan. And then alpenei tahom, over the surface of the deep, that's the gullus of Edom. That's the gullus of Esav. That's earlier on in the Psukim. Sorry, in the end of Pasuk Lamed. Al-Kain Kara Shemo Edom. Esav is Edom. The Malchus of Edom that we go through, that is Esav. And Esav is the last exile, that long exile. The Medrash there says in Bereishit Rabbah, Al Pnei Tahom, that extends upon the surface of the deep. That just like the Tahom, the deep is long and seemingly endless, so too is the last exile going to be long and seemingly endless. That's the 2,000-year exile of Edom. Very beautifully, the Midrash ends off. The Ruach Elokim Mirachefet Al Pnei Hamayim. The Ruach Elokim Ruchol Shel Mashiach. Is merachavet al pnei amayim. What brings the ruchos shel Mashiach? Shifchi kamayim libeich nochach pnei Hashem. When we let our hearts pour out in tshuva, then Mashiach will come and end the process of exile, and we totally return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we'll finally see the end of the Dalad Malchiyot, the four exiles, the four kingdoms, and we'll see the Malchut of Yisrael emerge on top, emerge at the end of days. Bezrat Hashem mirav yamin. You still say amen, it's not the end of this year. Right? Still say amen. There we go. Okay. So that's the exile that we're living in. Now again, there's a lot more to unpack there, which is why there's a whole shiur just on this piece. But it means that the exile that we're in right now, if it's the exile of Edom, it's the exile of Sheker. It's the exile of Sheker. And when you start looking at the principles of healthy eating, you start seeing how the realities of Edom, the mentality of Edom, the mentality of Esav, and this final gullus are so much, meaning it's going to penetrate every area of life. That's what makes it a malchus. But it also absolutely penetrates into the realm of food as well. I want to share with you all, leaving Torah sources behind, my Rebbe in health.
Michael Pollan.
This is an excerpt from one of his articles. I highly recommend checking out his works. I took this from one of his opening... it's an easy way to enter the rabbit hole of health. Michael Pollan is a food journalist, and he's the first person to say how ridiculous it is that in our day and age we need food journalists to explain what food. We need investigative journalists to understand what the heck food is, and he's the first one to admit that is very odd. I gave you an excerpt from the article here. I found it online. I knew what article I was looking for, but I googled it. But you can find it online. But also on the back, there's a link to you can read the whole article. You can look for. You can't click on the piece of paper, but you can look up the article. just make sure everybody's still awake. We're coming close to 10 o'clock, so you can check it on your own, or you could just Google unhappy meals and Michael Pollan. So this is from the New York Times Magazine, January 20th, 2007. So he opens up with his Torah Sheba Al Peh. Torah Sheba Al Peh is always said very short. And there's a lot of meaning behind everything. This is his Torah Sheba'al Peh. It's 6 words long. This is the entirety of health according to Michael Pollan. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. V'idazil more. He doesn't write that. Right? Go on from there. Right, but that's it. That's based this Kol Torah Kula on one leg. That's it. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And this article is a book everybody has to read. It's called Omnivore's Dilemma. It's the first book that I lent to you, called The Omnivore's Dilemma. The first 2 pieces of that book really open up. He cracks open, from an investigative journalistic standpoint, the food system. And it's also incredible because, he's a real writer. So, like, you're captivated by this novel about corn, and you're like, you put it down, you're like, I don't know what just happened, but it was great. He's just, it's incredibly captivating writing, and it's very, very important. What he does here in this article is he gives, I gave you the first line, which is what we're going to open up a little bit, and I gave you the bottom line of the article, which is cheating, because you really want to read the article to earn it, but he gives here on the article, these two pages are his kind of 10 principles of eating, because I didn't want to leave you without anything practical in terms of how to deal with the modern food system. So the first thing of these 10 principles, I'm just sharing with you a little bit of Michael Pollan.
It's 9.
There's no 10. It was just 9 there. I just assumed it was 10. It's supposed to be, in Torah, it would have been a round number. Good. But it's not Torah. Okay. So he says first.
That is Torah.
He says first. He says first, eat food. Eat food. And that's not a simple thing, and that's what he goes through in his article. And he says, though in our current state of confusion, that's much easier said than done. So try this. Don't eat anything your great-great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. Right? And that's a challenging thing. You know, we go to stores, and things become much more complicated. Taking us to principle number 2. Avoid even those food products that come bearing health claims. Food doesn't need to sell itself. Food is food. It was never complicated before. It shouldn't be complicated now. So if a food is telling you, I'm really, really, really healthy, you know what it's probably not? It's probably not healthy.
So true.
And it's very dangerous. Because we've come down to this reality where food is presenting itself. Oh, wow, what's the in-vogue nutrient of the day? And he talks a lot about these issues. What's the in-vogue nutrient of the day? Right? Is it antioxidants? Is it omega-3s? Right? Is it low carb? Is it low trans fat? Is it low sugar? What's the thing that we're focused on in this particular moment in time? And what's incredible and what's frightening about the modern-day industrial food system is that whenever there's a new fad, so you just turn the dial. You turn down this nutrient and you turn up that nutrient. And suddenly now we're repackaging a package of cookies and we're saying, look, it's low in trans fats, high in omega-3s. Go for it. The only thing that it's lacking is healthful content. The only problem is that it's going to hurt your body. That's the Sheker of Esav. That little bit of saying, no, no, no. And that's even what Rashi says. He says, no, he went to his father. He's like, no, what about, I have a shayla in this. Why do you have a shayla in this? Because he had no idea what he was talking about. He had a shayla in this. So good. Now he's looking, now it has omega-3s. Doesn't matter that it has omega-3s. If you're eating something that's going to be poisonous to your body, if you take Drano from under your sink and you pour omega-3 inside of it, you're not going to eat it anyway. It doesn't change anything. It's very, very dangerous. And that's what he's saying here, is that if a food is telling you that it's really, really healthy, be careful. Be careful. Avoid health claims. I've never yet seen an apple which has been packaged telling me, or an orange is saying, packed with vitamin C. And you're wondering, why haven't the orange company started doing that? They're not. It's always the prepackaged food. Number 3. Especially avoid food products containing ingredients that are 1. Unfamiliar, 2. Unpronounceable, and 3. More than 5 in number. Look at the ingredients list. That's what Esav is all about. Don't just look at the outside. Don't take it at face value. What's actually inside? What's going on beneath the surface? Because once echad bepev echad baliv, it's going to taste good in your mouth. It's going to hurt your heart. Right? That's not what the phrase actually means. Right? But you have to be very careful. What's actually going on inside of that food? Look at the ingredients list. Thank God the FDA still requires that at least that's list the ingredients. And if you see there things that you have no idea what they are and don't look or sound like food, it means that it's probably not food. If it has more than 5 ingredients, it means that the package itself is containing something that's probably not food. Think about these things critically. And I'll tell you also, it sounds crazy at the beginning, and it sounds impossible at the beginning, but when you see 80 different types of tomato sauce on the shelf, if you look hard and long enough, you are going to find one can that's going to contain tomato paste, water, and salt. That's the one that you want. It's the other ones you want to be wary about, and that's, you have that option. And once you know which one you want, then you keep getting the same one. But that's something that you want to look for. I don't actually know what goes into food. I don't shop for ingredients. I buy oranges and apples. My wife is the one who goes shopping for the actual food. I don't know what makes a good tomato sauce. But you look in what's the ingredients to make sure that there are things you can pronounce less than 5 and that they're real food. And be wary of things that contain high fructose corn syrup. The biggest danger, bismanazin, in food
sugar.
Is likely, you know, I can't say anything definitively because I'm not a nutritionist, is likely sugar. I say likely in the strongest of terms. It's likely sugar, whether it's sugar or high fructose corn syrup or all of the many unpronounceable non-food names that it hides under. It's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. And if you have no idea why sugar is probably very dangerous and why you should probably have no sugar, it means that you haven't begun to go down the rabbit hole of health. So you can take the most simple and elementary of documentaries and watch Fed Up.
Fed Up?
Yeah. No, not Fed Up.
In Defense of Who?
No. The one with, what's her name? With Katie Couric.
No, it's Fed Up.
That is Fed Up. Yes, Fed Up. Okay, good.
I prepped.
Is Fed Up. It's very simple and it's a little bit repetitive. But like when I've sat down and gone through pieces of it with students who don't know anything about this stuff, like they were gasping through the whole thing. And we stopped to talk about it and like they were like, no, it's not possible. And the answer is yes, it's very possible and it's very frightening. It's very frightening.
We'll text out a list of all 5 documentaries on that.
Yeah. The order that I would recommend, and we'll be going through this as we keep going through this anyway, is start with Fed Up. Go on to King Korn, which is definitely hard to get through. Go on to King Korn. Yes, go on to King Korn, where these two guys go out to a farm where their family grew up on, and they actually buy an acre of industrial corn, and they try to grow it. And the beginning when they're doing all of the, like, I don't find the human interest stuff particularly interesting. I was watching it to understand how corn is produced, how we get to industrial high fructose corn syrup. You watch them actually grow the corn. You watch them taste what type 2 corn tastes like, and then you watch how corn gets from the fields to the supermarket, and that's how you understand how all of our food has become poisoned. Because it doesn't say sugar, assuming sugar is as bad for you as it probably is, it doesn't say sugar on every food, but you see high fructose corn syrup on a lot of food, and you see other variations on high fructose corn syrup. Why is that so dangerous? Between Fed Up and King Korn, if you can make it through them, which I don't mind them, and I like.
What is high fructose corn syrup? Like, what is it?
It's basically the easiest and most and the cheapest way of producing sugar.
Oh, okay.
It's the cheapest way of producing sugar. And once you get there, then you go into the end of my trilogy, which is Food Inc., which once you have that background, you can understand Food Inc. in a much deeper way, and you understand then what are the ramifications of that corn and the type 2 corn and the high fructose corn syrup, the ramifications of that getting into literally all of our food, into our meat, into our supermarkets, into every aspect of our lives and every aspect of our food, how deep it goes. If you're somebody who can handle it, just read Omnivore's Dilemma or do them both at the same time. But that's kind of it. Let's keep going through the list. But definitely, according to him, avoid high fructose corn syrup. Get out of the supermarket whenever possible. You won't find any high fructose corn syrup in the farmer's market. And you also won't find food harvested too long ago or far away. There's a lot of benefits to eating local good food. That's obviously much harder. That's obviously a quote-unquote higher madriga. But if you can eat local food, or you can look for farmer's markets, or first of all, the food does taste richer because it's not picked early. It doesn't have as much. It's often, if you ask, some of the livestock don't have a lot of pesticides. They don't, and they're ripe and they're fresh and they're local, so they're going to be more nutrient-rich. They're going to taste better. Pay more, eat less. That comes back to, first was not eat food, is eat food. We have to redefine, again, this, we're just skimming this, but eat food. First is, we just define food. Food is things that you can pronounce, that are simple, that have less than 5 ingredients, that you understand what they are, and it's very likely that sugar is not a good food for you. It may not be a food at all. So pay more, eat less. Yes, in certain instances, healthier food will cost more. We don't need to be eating as much as we're eating. And I'm not saying that in terms of obsessing about weight and obsessing about calories. We haven't used any of those words. This is not a talk designed to obsess over weight or calories in that way. It's saying that our society has been designed to try to get us to eat as much as possible. You look up or you watch these documentaries and you see what the FDA recommends in terms of what normal portion sizes are. No restaurant gives you a normal portion size of food. It's not our fault. We've been trained to assume that we need to have 3 to 4 times more of a normal portion size. And it's poison for our bodies. If you go back to the Rambam, Maimonides, you go back to the Mishnah Torah, where he talks there in Perek Dalet of Hilchot Deot, he says it's better to eat it's better to eat less of bad food than to overeat good food. Even if it's good food.
Bad food. His definition of bad food is probably like honey or something.
No, his definition of bad food was similar things. And either way, you can trust Michael Pollan. Look at what he considers good foods. Right? So eating too much is a problem. We're not talking about weight. We're not talking about calories. We're talking about simply maintaining good, healthful way of going through life. And if it costs a little bit more, it's fine because you should be eating a little bit less. And think and look up what normal portion sizes are. And it takes time to adjust because our bodies think they want more. And that also comes back to Esav. When Esav comes back from the Sadev, who I ate, and he's tired, he finds Yaakov is doing what?
Cooking lentil
soup. And what does he say to Esav? What does he say to Yaakov? Halitaini na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh ki ayef anochi al kein kara shemo adom. He gets the name because of the way that he related to
food.
Never seen that written anywhere, but to me there's a lot of issues underlying here that I think penetrate the food system. And the fact that the issue is relating around food, and he says halitaini, he doesn't say ha'achileini, I want to eat. There's a lot of discussion in the deeper sources of what halitaini means. That it's a type of eating that is a totally physical eating of just literally pour it down my throat. Guzzling it down. Or if you will, fast food. It was the first fast food. And he was so desperate, he was so addicted to that fast food, that he says, fine, whatever, birthright, brachas, whatever, take whatever you want. Just pour the food down my throat, that's all I really care about. That's it. I don't care what it is. It's red, it's food, it's good, that's all I care about. Pour it down my throat. Halitaini na. In fact, the tikkun, what's the month that we make a tikkun on eating? It's not a trick question, but it's a tough question. What's the month in the Jewish year that we do a tikkun on eating?
That's what I would think. No?
We're running out.
Oh, what's the one in Tu
B'Shvat? Tu B'Shvat. Shvat is the month of the tikkun of eating. We're coming back to what does it mean to really eat properly, to come back to eating fruit, to eating to trees which themselves take every ounce of potential and transform it into fruit. They don't waste potential. It's a lot of deep things with Tu B'Shvat. It's not a plug for it, meaning we're hosting it anyway. But if on Tu B'Shvat, you can ask Rob and she'll tell you where to find us. But I run a Tu B'Shvat Seder every year because I love Tu B'Shvat. Every year, yeah. And it is one of my favorite holidays, and we have a full-fledged Tu B'Shvat Seder with 4 cups of wine and with different types of fruit, and we go for a few hours, and it's amazing. It's one of my favorite times of the year. But the Sefer Yetzirah talks about the different months. To quote Sefer Yetzirah means to not really know what we're talking about, but let's quote it anyway, which it says, Haliteni ot tzadi bile'ita by Shvat. That the letter tzadi is related to Shvat, and that it's related to this haliteni, this le'ita, that we do a tikkun on this constant eating, of this eating of a totally physical nature, by using which letter?
Tzadi,
which is the tzadik, she'tzadik ochel osova nafsho. And there's a whole, even in that sentence, that small sentence from the Sefer Yetzirah, you can look in the Sfarim, you can look at the Bnei Yisachar, there's a beautiful piece that's a little bit more accessible in the Or Gedal Yahu in Chumash. He has a piece there in Tu B'Shvat around that time, around the beginning of Shmot, where he talks about it, very, very beautiful, very deep things. But that's where Esav is coming from. He's the Halitaini. The Gemara says, Halitaini l'rasha v'yamot. Let the Rasha eat, just guzzle it down and let him die. And that's what Esav's all about. Esav is moving towards death. What does the pasuk say? Let's go back to that pasuk by him. We'll finish up in like around 5 minutes. We'll get to the end. I have too many papers going on. Yeah, here. Where he says, "Give me the." Yaakov says, "Give me the bechorah." So Esav says, "V'yomer Esav, hine ani holech lamut v'lamazeli bechorah." My whole being is geared towards death. And there's a lot of depth to that. In the gullus of Esav and under the malchus of Edom and its different variations, there have been more Jewish blood spilled than under any malchus of the world. In all its variations. Hani olich lamut. V'lam ezli b'chora. What a kind of b'chora? My whole being is moving towards death. When we're eating bad food, we're moving towards death. When we're eating food, when we're going towards foods, these destructive foods, we're poisoning our bodies. And we don't even understand it. When we pick something off, and it's so sad because it's Esav. So he's pretending to be the tzaddik. So we go into the food store, and we go, and we take off. We're trying to do our best. We're innocently pulling off a box of food that tells me that it's healthy, that says that it's low in this, and low in this, and high in this, and high in this, and big letters on the front. And I think I'm doing good. It's all leading towards death. It's very, very dangerous. We're killing ourselves with this food. We don't even realize that we're poisoning our bodies with this food. The rate of type 2 diabetes in children and young adults is astronomically higher than it's ever been in the history of humankind. We are literally slowly killing ourselves with the modern day food system. Because Esav is putting into the food. He's putting death into the food. And we're guzzling it down, and we're all doing fast food. Fast food is cheap because why can it be cheap? You ever wonder that? You ever wonder how it could be that you ever look at the secular world and you wonder how certain stores can have 99-cent meals and how they can still make money? Think about it for a second. That means that all of that food has to be worth less than 99 cents for them to make a profit. Which means that that food might look like a bun, it might look like a hamburger, those might look like french fries, but evidently it's something else that the cumulative total of that is still less than 99 cents. And remember that while our cows are shechted, and the food's going to cost more and be treated is going to be treated much better, we're all buying the same cows. Ours are shechted and go through kosher processing, but it's the same cows who are being fed and raised the same way. It's possibly very dangerous. We have to start thinking about what we're eating and how we're eating. And that you're going to find that in a food label. That you're going to have to actually read on Divorce Dilemma. You're going to actually have to watch those two documentaries to begin to understand why is that the case and what am I even supposed to look out for? How do I see past the sheker of the ace of the world? It's not a simple thing. Parentheses, then start to realize that if it's true by food and we're living in the malchus of Esav, that means it's applied to every aspect of life. We're starting to see this. You look at something like the news. What is the news supposed to do? Report the truth. And suddenly in modern days, what are we struggling with? Literally the national conversation is, what is truth? There are facts and there are alternative facts. And there's this type of fact and there's that type of fact. And we have no idea what truth is. And it depends on which type of news outlet you read. You can have this type of truth or that type of truth. If you start going area by area throughout the world, we're living in a reality of Esav, it's the struggle to define what is Emmet in the reality of Sheker. It's an incredible thing. It's something which is why it's a whole shir that we're giving later on next week in the Midrash. It's so, so kedai. It's so important. It's one of the key issues to start thinking about in this world. Let's finish and go through the last few practical suggestions that he makes here. Eat mostly plants, especially leaves. He says, scientists may disagree on what's so good about plants. The antioxidants, the fiber, the omega-3s. It doesn't matter. The answer is it's the food, which is his point in his other in the rest of his writings. But they do agree that they're probably really, really, they're probably really good for you, and they certainly can't hurt. Plants are the absolute most healthy thing that you can possibly eat. I've often wondered about this. When we talk about the concept of Klal Yisrael in relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in terms of astronomy, what is HaKadosh Baruch Hu and what is Klal Yisrael?
We're the stars. Sun and moon.
The sun and the moon. There is a beautiful dream with Yosef that also deals with issues of stars, and that gets back to the Shvatim. That's a different shear. But in terms of Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's the sun, and we're supposed to reflect the sun. I've often wondered, so what are we trying to do? The closer that we get to photosynthesis, the closer that we get to food that is literally transforming sun into energy, literally giving us, allowing us to eat from the sun, eat from that which is supposed to be representative of godliness. This is my suspicion, I've never seen this written anywhere, that that's how we know how you're getting closer to the amos, you're getting closer to something which is truly wholesome and good. You're eating a plant, you're getting closer to the sun, you're good. And that's why fruit are incredibly healthy, but even better than fruit or vegetables. Because the fruit are even one step removed from that. And then once removed from that is going to be animals. And the farther and farther, and then one step away from that is whatever the heck is being processed 10 generations later in the box that's in the supermarket. The closer you get back to the source of the sun, I suspect it's also ashkafically, the closer you're getting back to the core ruchnius of the food, and that's why it's in from a ruchni place it's going to be the most healthy. But again, eat mostly plants, especially leaves. Then he says, eat more like the French. And then he clarifies, more like the Japanese or the Italians or the Greeks, meaning basically anybody but America. He says in the opening of the Amun War's Dilemma, it's apologies that I'm able to quote this, I can quote Chumash, but again, this in our day and age is one of the key issues that we need to struggle with, and I've read them a couple of times. He says that we often talk about in America of the French paradox, of a culture that eats incredibly unhealthy foods, they eat whatever they want, and they are immensely more healthy than Americans are, than Western culture is. And he says, because we have the stupidity to give it something the name like the French paradox, he said it's not the French paradox, it's the Western paradox, which is how can a society that's obsessed with health be the most unhealthy nation in the entire world? It's not the French that are a paradox, it's America that's the paradox, it's the Western world that's a paradox. And again, Edom is linked to this malchus of the Western world. It's linked to Edom, and Edom is assumed by the later sources to be the manifestation of the Western world. That's being the dominant cultural force. That basically more like anybody but Esav, but the way that Esav eats. Cook, it's a good one. Cook, what's it for me? I never cook. I know I'd use the toaster oven. I figured it out. Sometimes even the oven itself. But like that's for serious, you know. That's for if there's really no food in the house that I can't put in. It's like I have a big tin, it's a whole thing. My wife is like, I don't know how to cook. It's one of the things I don't know how to do. But I'm zochet to a wife who does cook a lot, and I'm very grateful for that. Who also is, believes in the importance of health. And if you can plant a garden, let's not take it that far. Let's hold off on the garden. But if you can cook, it's worth investing in your food. When you make your own food, it means that you're taking actual food, actual ingredients. You're choosing what you're putting together. You're choosing how much you make. You actually know what's going into it. And you understand what's going into your body. You're recreating a relationship with food. The more distance we have from food, the more it can deceive us. The closer we are to the food, the more we're connected to it, the more we're able to be more alive. And again, eat like an omnivore, which leads into the Omnivore's Dilemma, which is the name of his book. But eat like an omnivore, meaning eat a variety in your diet. Don't become monochromatic. Here's where I'm taking a major leap, but I feel like we've earned each other's trust at this point, or I've earned your trust enough that, like, if I sound crazy once, it'll be fine. It's something which actually stuck out to me when I was thinking about these issues, not in this parsha, but in next parsha, in Parshat Vayishlach. But Vayishlach is when Yaakov and Esav come back to meet together. How does Yaakov present himself to Esav when he walks up to Esav? How does he come? With whom?
His wives, kids.
He comes with his wives and with his children, with his family. How does Esav come?
400 men.
400 soldiers. Again, this is me totally taking it way too far, but when I see that scene, and I'm thinking about these issues, when you start reading the books and understanding how the importance of the ecology of a farm is and an ecosystem is and how important that is to having good, wholesome food, what I see when I see Esav walking up is I see the modern industrialized food system where you see 400 identical-looking soldiers standing in perfect lines, all identical. I see, a field of corn. Field of corn. And what comes up to meet him? Where is Yaakov's whole koach coming from? He comes with a vibrant ecosystem of a family, where everybody has a diverse piece and everybody's adding to that system to create an ecology that's positive and that's healthy. And that's the healthy life of Yaakov versus the destructive reality of Esav, literally and figuratively. Take it or leave it. But that's what I see when I see that in one way. But that's the same. Be an omnivore also, I would say it's even broader than that. Think about the ecology. When you're eating food, you're eating food. And again, that's the whole point. Don't obsess. It's the Western diet-oriented system and nutrient-oriented system that is unhealthy. We, quote-unquote, don't know why. Let's pretend we don't know why. We don't know why. But people who are just eating food are doing just fine. And so to go and to eat real food, then you can eat not whatever you want, meaning you still want to make healthful choices. You still want to avoid things that are potentially very dangerous, like sugar. You still want to do that. But if you have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and even the French have dessert. And I'm not advocating for dessert. I don't eat dessert. I think that dessert is just destructive. That's not something that I would do. But the French who do eat dessert are doing just fine. So the goal here is not to tell you not to eat things. The goal here is not to tell you to start dieting, to start getting crazy about this or crazy about that. Here are 9 relatively simple principles, if you even take just some of them, eat actual foods, avoid foods that have big health claims on the box, avoid foods that have too many ingredients, ingredients you can't name, or more than five ingredients. If you have the opportunity, which is not as practical for many people, but if you have the opportunity, try to, you know, go to farmers markets or places that are outside of supermarkets and actually get whole foods. Pay more, eat less. Think about portion sizes, not in an obsessive and unhealthy way. Think about portion sizes just in terms of what is proper health. What just the FDA says is a good right amount that we should be eating. And say I want to try to get closer to that, slowly but surely scale back because I want to be healthy. Not because I want to diet, because I want to be healthy. And if this is what science knows my body needs, and the Ram says better to eat less unhealthy food than too much of even healthy food, to think about maybe I don't even know that I'm overeating because the secular world has tricked me into thinking that this is a normal portion. Maybe I don't want or need that much. Just to think about it, not obsess over it, to think about it. To come back to the earth, fruits, and especially vegetables. Have vegetables be your primary food. He talks about other places. Your salads, your vegetables, those should be your main dish. And if you want a side dish, again, you're not restricting anything. You want a side dish of meat or poultry. That's great. But have the primary core of your meal for all meals. Have it be plants. Have it be fruits. Have it be vegetables. Specifically vegetables. Eat more like the French. Diversify. Don't only eat this bar at this time, and this health food at this time, and this shake at this time. This is all garbage. Eat food. Eat meals. Cook if you can. Create a relationship with your food, a healthy relationship with your food, and all levels of what the word healthy means. And eat more like an omnivore. Again, diversify what we're eating. If we're going to talk about being wholesome and holy, a Torah perspective. One of the beautiful things about Torah is that in Torah you can have the deepest depths of Kabbalah, and at the same time, then you flip the page and it goes and tells you which way you're supposed to put on your shoes. Right? So I felt that if we're going to do a shir that's going to, and also knowing, you know, Robin's personality, if we're going to do a shir that's going to be on health, she would accept no less than getting into the depth of what Kedusha is. We have to live in the trees, live in the realm of what is Kedusha. How do I be Kadosh? Why do I have to be Kadosh? Why is that linked to food? The depth of what it means to eat in a way of Kedusha, which is also very lofty but more specific. But I felt that it was very important to also end off by giving 9 suggestions from an investigative food journalist, again, who admits that his title is ridiculous, right? That from, you know, 9 practical suggestions about how to begin thinking about food properly, and also hopefully to spur you to both learn even more Torah sources and read more Michael Pollan and things that he quotes, and watch more documentaries to better understand food, because by eating in a proper way, we keep ourselves healthy, we will live longer, we will live better, and these are the gateways to Kedusha. These are the gateways to Kedusha. B'ezrat Hashem, we should be zoche to have the clarity to be able to be both healthy and kadosh, and through that do a tikkun on all levels of being, physically and spiritually, and help bring the ultimate tikkun to this world. Amen.